Okay, so we are on part four of the four-part series, and we're going to jump right in. As always, I begin with just making sure we create the frame. Absolutely a fraught and sensitive topic. We'll be making readings that people have to have a certain amount of generosity to accept. Giving both the text and me the benefit of the doubt will be very appreciated. We will be using gendered language, but trying to balance it as best we can. We are again adopting, as the Torah does, the heteronormative frame. We will be using open and direct language. And again, we'll be making comparisons, a lot of comparisons, and they're useful as far as they go, but they're not meant to equate things that are being compared. Okay, my shiur today is called Ford versus Ferrari. And like lots of you, I only found out about this topic after going to see that great movie with Christian Bale and Matt Damon. But it sets up, I think, a model, which I hope you'll tell me yes or no. It's very useful talking about sexuality in Tanakh, and I'll explain why. Once again, I'll be lecturing straight, and if there are questions, we'll leave time at the end. Please put them in the chat as we go along. And even as you did last time, which was really so useful to me, feedback, questions, points, or responses. I'm sorry I can't do it more interactive than that, but this is the way we're going to do it. Okay. In 1966, there was a very significant Le Mans race. Le Mans is a race in France. It's called an endurance race. And that's significant, meaning we're not just looking for the fastest car. We're looking for a car that is able to go as far as it can in 24 hours of constant driving. So it's not just the car that has the biggest motor. It's the car that has, won't break or can be fixed quickly or the brakes can be replaced. There's lots of things that go into winning the Le Mans, not just power and speed. When the first race started in 1923 to the year before this significant race, Ferrari had won the most Le Mans victories of nine. There were English victories. America had won zero. They first entered in 1929 with a car from DuPont, and it broke down after 3 hours. But in 1966, as was very dramatically reported by this movie, Ford came in not only first, but second and third. And the backdrop was Ford had tried to buy Ferrari. Ferrari rejected it. And this was really a contest of wills and personalities between Enzo Ferrari and Henry Ford II. And so it was a large drama. Ford wins the next three races. In other words, winning Le Mans once signifies, as it did Ferrari itself, some kind of ascendance that gave you a bunch of victories. And why it's repeatable will be one of the questions that we're going to ask. Ferrari did not win again until 2023, which is really just this year. And I think it's really interesting. I think the movie probably put a little bit of a bee in their bonnet, and they went on to win just this year for the first time since 1966. My questions are the following, and these are actually the main characters in the picture. Ken Miles, the main driver, played by Christian Bale on the right. Carroll Shelley, played by Matt Damon, the car designer and the owner on the left. So my question is this. Why does Ford win in 1966, Ferrari not win for 30 years, 40 years later? And why does winning once mean that there's something repeatable? Second, who cares? Why did Ford put millions in order to win this race? Why does a person buy a Ford car just because a very different, specially designed race car wins a race in France? What does that race car, that GT40, have anything to do with going into the store and buying a Ford Mustang? And what has any of this to do with sexuality or Tanakh? Okay, that's the questions. Here's the frame. My answer, and this is a picture of the actual finish line with the Fords in one, two, and three, is as follows. When those three Fords cross the finish line together, every American man and every American woman became slightly more attractive became just a little more sexy than their Italian counterparts. It mattered. It mattered to all of America. So how that works and why that works and if that works and whether Tanakh agrees, that's going to be my shear. Fords, Ferraris, and Pharaohs. We'll talk about how Pharaohs comes in, really dealing with sex and culture. Okay, today's agenda. We've told the story of Le Mans 1966. We're going to review two important points to make my case, drawing from part one and two. We're going to read three stories from Tanakh about Achoti At, saying you are my sister. It's a very interesting story. We're going to then go back to part three about the wayward woman and correct something and talk about cultural degradation. And we're going to ask a very important question, how and why and if sex is separate from fertility. And conclude with important comment of sex in service of family. Okay. Here we go. Here's the car. And I want you to do this thought experiment for me. If I tell you this car is a particular kind of car, and I'll give you different suggestions, I want you to think, maybe even write down in the chat, what comes to mind with each association. So if I tell you this car is Japanese, what does that make you think? If I tell you the car is German, what do you think? It's Korean. It's Italian. It's Polish. What do you think? It's Israeli. What do you think? It's American. Those associations, those brand names, those qualities that go with naming this car as a particular kind of car belonging to a particular culture or a particular subset begins to get at the question. Okay. We're going to have to go back to a conversation about gender roles. And before I do that, I want to make some really careful points that I made before, because it's obviously a fraught issue. We're talking about generalizations, defaults, and approximations. No one is saying that anybody necessarily falls into this or that exact gender role. These relate to biology. There's reasons why these defaults exist relating to the difference in biological roles and reproduction. But it's not limited to biology. These are things that relate to the collective of men and women. It's not something necessarily that relates, but certainly can influence the individual. Gender roles, and I made this point in share number two, can be adopted, they can be subverted, and they can be rejected. Meaning the fact that there exists a gender role doesn't mean that you have to adopt it. And they're more relative and relational than absolute, meaning it relates to what the Torah talks about as being ezer kenegdo, one standing over against, helping and keneged, against, a counterpart. So these roles end up sort of splitting men, women in different roles that kind of complement and set each other in a sort of tension. And I'll explain what I mean. So we're talking about Le Mans in 1966. And we're talking about cars and brand names. And so I want to make a chart with you. There's a car, and this picture is going to follow us through over here. It's a typical car advertisement with a beautiful woman in the car wanting you to buy that car. And we're going to analyze that. And we're going to separate the car, the instrument of that's being built, from the owner of the car, which is going to relate more to the feminine. And I'll explain what that means in a second. There's the GT40 that raced in Le Mans, but the aspect of that GT40 that won, that's Ford, that's the brand name, that's the family or institution to which it belongs, that's going to be also along a kind of tension or an axis relating the male towards the specific GT40 to the brand name, which is towards the feminine, which is the Ford. In other words, or another way of getting at this question is you have athletes that are there to compete, the specific athletes that are in a sports. And then you have another role of the referees who dictate the rules of the game. That again is a kind of getting at the masculine feminine divide that I'm trying to look at. You have the competitive sports car, and then you have the event. And what I learned is that the Le Mans has lots of rules about it. What What makes the car competitive? What makes the competition fair? And so there's two different questions that people are asking. How do I win this event? And is the event fair? Are the issues that I want to have compete the right issues? And have I balanced it in terms of like having the right amount of money and made the competition getting at the qualities that I want it to get at? In Le Mans, for instance, you in certain categories, you can't spend more money. The engines have to be a certain size so we get at the driver speed. All sorts of things that kind of focus the competition in a particular area, making it not fair in the sense an even playing ground. There's the car specs. This particular car is faster. It handles well. It has great output. It's efficient. And then there's the car's price. And why that's different, I want to say, is that the car's price puts it all together. The car's price is how I balance all those qualities. Do I want to buy this car or not? How much does it matter if it has bucket seats or leather interior? And how much does it matter? How do I balance all the variable things that I want to do to make this car a whole car? So the parts of the car, the individual qualities, the competitive edge, male, breaking it down. The overall price, is it worth it? How much to pay for such a car? More to the feminine. Competition versus cooperation. Getting that edge versus trying to create an overall place where we can all come to and it's fair. Le Mans is a corporation. It's a sporting event. And that frame is more to getting at the language, the rules, the domestication that create the event. On one hand, the male is trying to find advantage, trying to exploit weakness. On the other hand, Ford is trying to share the knowledge of this GT40 with all their other cars. They're trying to teach a whole generation and replicate the success that they find in building these cars. That's why buying a Ford has a kind of shared attractiveness to it. It matters that a Ford over there, because supposedly or presumably, Ford knows how to build good cars. It's not the car that you're buying. It's the know-how. It's the knowledge that exists inside of Ford that if they can do this GT40, then they probably do something good in the Mustang that you go ahead and buy. The teaching, the replication of what is gained by those advantages becomes more of the overall sharing of the feminine. So there's the car and the brand. There's the engineers versus the marketing, proving that the overall is something that's attractive. And if I take it back to male and feminine, Sparta, the competitive, the fierce, the warriors of Sparta and their guard Apollo, which is the symbol, the male symbol atop, the shield and the sword, versus Athens and Athena, the feminine god, which is about democracy, about a system, about a city that is fair and competes over culture. And that kind of rounds out this sort of tension I want to build. Okay. The last thing I want to set up in terms of getting at these stories about Achotiat, she is my sister, is reaching back to Shir number one and the Eitz Hadaat, the tree of knowledge and eating of the fruit. There, I wanted to make the point that desire is generalized and that you can share attractiveness. And the mistake is getting too specific, thinking that I want this specific thing and not something which is more broad. So we spoke about, what do you want? And if I just want fruit, I'm happy with fruit. It doesn't matter so much. And my love of fruit can be shared between apples and pears. And if I have an excellent apple, it could be that I'm all excited to have a great pear. My expectation of desire, the reward that I've learned from one exemplar can extend to other things of that broader set. And how I define the broader set is sort of the question. And over there in Shir number two, we talked really specifically about sharing attractiveness when we told the story of Leah and Rachel. Here are two sisters. Sisters, it's very key that we're talking about sisters here. Where one was attractive, found the love and passion of Yaakov. And what Rachel did with that is she shared it with her sister. She said, you go marry him first instead of me. The Midrash says that she passed on certain codes, perhaps the beauty codes of culture. And Yaakov ended up marrying both those wives. And that was obviously complicated and created for all sorts of tensions, which we delved in a little bit before and we'll talk about today. But the key point over here was, in a certain sense, Yaakov erred, sinned in the sense of not doing something wrong, but sinned in the sense of making an error in believing that he could only love Rachel. He learned in that story attempted to learn, and again, it wasn't a simple thing at all, that he could love and incorporate into his home both Rachel and Leah. Okay. So that's the introduction. Those are the main points I want to make. And now we're diving into this question of sex and culture and this strange story of she is my sister. I want to point out that this refrain is a type. The story follows three times, and we're going to talk about all three of them. Avram and Sarai go down to Egypt, and they're threatened there. And Avram says to Sarai, I'm worried. Please say to them that you're not my wife, but you're my sister. Avram is renamed Avraham from Avram, and Sarai is renamed Sarah. And then they go down to Gerar on the border of Egypt and Israel, and they do a similar story. And again, he says, she is my sister. And then their children, Yitzchak and Rivka, go down to Gerar, that same place. And once again, the claim is, she's my sister. And we'll read what happens. But this is a thrice repeated story. The Torah, you know, we all know every word counts, and the commonalities and the differences between the stories is what we're going to examine. But it's got to say something important. And to be honest, most of the time when I've looked into this story a lot and seen it treated, I haven't seen an approach that really grasps what I think is, why repeat the story three times? What is being told here that's so significant? And I hope to dig at that a little bit. Again, I'm just touching the surface here, and would be happy to be pointed in areas that are more. So we jump in. First story, Genesis 12. There's a problem. There's a famine in the land, and Avram descended to Egypt to sojourn there because the famine was heavy in the land. When he approached Egypt, he said to his wife Sarai, behold, please, I know that you are a beautiful woman. When the Egyptians see you, they will say, this is his wife. They will kill me, but you they will keep alive. Please say that you are my sister, that it may be well with me on account of you, and that I may leave because of you. Now, if you feel like Avraham has done something wrong here, you're not alone. There are plenty of Mefarshim that critique Avraham, maybe not this story, later on. But if we just jump in here to see what Avram did wrong and just criticize, I think we'll really miss the part of the story. The Torah doesn't tell us mistakes in order to show us, you know, how silly or wrong the Avos and Imos were. They're showing us a deep and inexorable kind of problem. It's the inevitability of them killing me that is really important here, and the limited solutions we have for dealing with that. And that's where I want to dig at. In other words, let's be generous and try to understand that Avram is not throwing his wife under the bus. He's not the cause of a cowardly flight from responsibility or an exploitation of his wife. There's something much more deep, much more intrinsic that we want to dig at over here. When Avram came to Egypt, the Egyptians saw that the woman was very beautiful. The officials of Paro saw her and praised her to Pharaoh, and the woman was taken to Paro's house. And he dealt well with Avram on her account, and he had sheep, cattle, male donkeys, servants, maidservants, female donkeys, and camels, all paid out, many donkeys for your sister. Hashem plagued Pharaoh and his household with great plagues because of Avram's wife Sarai. So there's a punishment here. There's a result for the fact that the Egyptians go ahead and take Sarai. These plagues are going to be a key part of the picture. Rashi comments on it that they were smitten with the plague of Ra'atan, which made sex difficult. It was, I don't know, some sort of venereal disease, or actually, I'm going to say something else in a moment, but it related to sexuality. Somehow, there was a cause and effect here. Bringing down Sarai into Egypt made sex difficult for Pharaoh, his household, and all of Egypt. Let's go back now for a second. If you notice, and the commentaries are bothered by this, this is where we went back earlier. When they approached Egypt, Sarah says, behold, hine, I know you're a beautiful woman. And the Mefarshim asked the question, what, you didn't know she was beautiful before then? You've been married for like 10 years. Why now do you notice? So there are various solutions. It was time on the trip, or I never really noticed. But Rashi says something difficult and hard. That we're going to deal with. They're going to Africa and they're traveling among black and ugly people who are related to the Cushites. So Sarah in Egypt, by contrast, is an attractive, fair woman. And that brings out a lot of attention. There's a change, I want to say, of beauty standard here. And all of a sudden, everybody finds Sarah really attractive. Now, I need to back up here because I know I kind of dropped a bombshell over here, and I want to diffuse it for a moment. And this is a shameless plug. If you go onto YouTube, I have a whole shiur on this that I really can't get into called Sarat, which is these plagues, these nigaim, and racism. And I deal with this problem at length. And I wasn't hesitant to share with you that very racist comment by Rashi, because although Rashi, living in Alsace-Lorraine in Ashkenaz, was clearly affected by a beauty standard common to his time and absolutely prevalent throughout all of Europe, the Torah is not. And the Torah has Moses marry a Cushite wife. And so it can't be that the Torah is buying into this beauty standard, because Moshe marries a Cushite wife. And in fact, it creates a problem where Miriam and Aaron complain about it. And Miriam is struck with a plague for doing so. So all of that is in the shir. I just mentioned it here because I don't want to get stuck by bringing in this racist comment and thinking that it paints everything the Torah has to say. It most definitely does not. Back to our story. Paro called Avram and said, what is this that you have done to me? Why did you not tell me that she is your wife? Why did you say she is my sister, so that I took her to me as a wife? Now here is your wife. Take her and go. Pharaoh commanded men over him, and they cast him out along with his wife and all that was his. And they throw Sarah and Abraham out of Egypt, and they leave, as they do 400 years later, with wealth, with tremendous wealth. So you have a really interesting model here. Some sort of subterfuge, some kind of confrontation, and a difficulty, and then leaving, being extracted from the problem. Let's see this model play itself again in the next story. Okay, again, we have Abraham now and Sarah going down to Gerar. And again, Abraham says to his wife, she is my sister. Okay, again, he didn't tell Sarah to do that. He just said himself now, she's my sister. And they go down to meet Avimelech. Hashem came to Avimelech in a dream at night and said to him, you are to die because of the woman you took. Sorry. I just want to make it clear. In verse 2, Abraham, the king of Gerar, sent and took Sarah. Okay? So whereas Pharaoh earlier had people bring Sarai to him, here Avimelech is affecting a certain agency, and he sends and takes Sarah to himself. Hashem comes in a dream, and God intervenes. You're going to die. But Avimelech genuinely approaches God and says, I'm innocent. He said she's my sister. And she also said he's my brother. I did this with an innocent heart and clean hands. God said to him in the dream, I know that you did this with an innocent heart. And I stopped you from sinning against me. Meaning I prevented you before you did anything. I did not allow you to touch her. And the word to touch, pay attention, in Hebrew is naga. You didn't touch her. Naga, which is exactly the same word for plagues. Nigaim. So there's definitely something interesting in that. God instructs him to return the wife and tell him to pray for you. Avimelech does exactly that. And then he tells all his people, and the people were very frightened about what just happened. Avimelech called Avraham and said to him, What have you done to us? How have I sinned against you that you brought upon me in my kingdom such great sin? Deeds that are not done you have done to me. Avimelech said to Avraham, what did you see that you did this thing? And Avraham said, because I thought, surely there is no fear of God in this place, and they will kill me on account of my wife. In addition, she is in truth my sister. She is the daughter of my father, but not the daughter of my mother, and she became my wife. The Torah says they're all descendants of Nahor, and they are indeed related, all part of the family. So Avraham is not lying in the sense of she's my relation. And calling her sister is very fair to say that about a relation. When God had me wander from my father's house, I told her, this is the kindness you can do for me. Any place we go, say of me that he is my brother. So it changes, not specifically over here, but this is a general thing about how they go about in their travels. Resolution. Again, wealth. Avimelech takes all this wealth and gives it back to his wife, Sarah. And then Avimelech invites them to stay and dwell there. And he says specifically to Sarah, I'm going to give you money specifically. And it is for you a covering of the eyes for all who are with you before all you are vindicated. Meaning, don't anybody think, Sarah, that you did anything wrong. And don't anybody think that I did anything wrong with you. You were untouched. And that's an important part of what Avimelech comes to testify. Avraham prays to God, and Avimelech is healed. His wife, his handmaids, and they give birth. This results in fertility. For God had punished also Avimelech, not with plagues, which made sex difficult, but the closing of the womb, which made birthing and fertility difficult. Okay, that's story number two. Very interesting. Number three, Yitzhak dwells in Gerar. The people of the place asked about his wife. And he said, she is my sister, because he feared to say my wife, lest the people of the place kill me on account of Rivka, because she is beautiful. As his days there stretched on, Avimelech, king of Philistine, looked out of the window and saw, and there was Yitzhak playfully interacting with his wife. Mitzachek, which is a play on the word Yitzhak. Again, totally lost in the English, but he is being Yitzchak with his wife. And that is a clear allusion to sexuality. But here it's related. Her beauty is discussed, is mentioned, but it's more about how beautiful she is for Yitzchak and Yitzchak for Rivka. It's about their relationship. Avimelech called to Yitzchak and said, but behold, she is your wife. How did you say she is my sister? Yitzchak said to him, because I thought, lest I die on her account. Avimelech said, what have you done to us? One of the people might have easily lain with your wife, and you would have brought guilt upon us. Avimelech commanded all the people, saying, whoever touches this woman, and there's the word again, the touching, shall surely be put to death. And now there's a rule, there's an institution about how Yitzchak and family and marriage is to be handled. And again, in the resolution, there is wealth. Yitzchak this time is not a herder, but a farmer. He sowed in the land and had 100-fold because Hashem had blessed him. That's Mea Sharim, which is an interesting phrase over there. Okay, those are the texts. Lots and lots to talk about. I hope I've piqued your curiosity. Again, I'm only going to be able to extract some very general things and encourage you to look at it further for yourselves. But here we go in terms of extracting and putting all this together. Just one second.
Could you just bring my phone so I can look at the time?
Sorry about that. Okay, here we go. Here we go. All of these stories happen on foreign ground, whether it's Egypt or Gerar. It happens because they leave their home territories of Eretz Yisrael. There is in all of them beauty and attraction that is embodied by the woman. There is a threat to the husband. In each case, it's called, they will kill me. I'd like to read this more generally. And the way I'd like to understand this is, there is sexual competition everywhere. And Abraham, as a new immigrant, as a foreigner in a strange land, has a twofold problem. On one hand, the newness, the beauty, the genetic expansion of the gene pool, the knowledge, the language, anywhere you look at it, the things that are repeatable, the things that one culture can take from another, inhere in the woman. That's what makes her beautiful and attractive. Every level of culture, from just physical beauty to productivity and fertility to language and cultural beauties, knowledge, math, science, all those things is the Athena, is the knowledge, is the replicatable parts of what people want from her. But if they're going to take the wife into their culture, they're going to dismiss the man. They will make him less attractive in the dominant culture. And he will go to work in the brickyard. He will lay train tracks. He will work at menial jobs because in our country, the good people look like us. And the foreigners work at things that are less valuable. This is the beginning of what becomes the slavery of Egypt. So he is already sensing this, that my value as a worker they're going to kill me. I will not be able to earn what I'm worth. My value will be dismissed. Again, if you think that's a pushed read, I want to show you that the brothers, we'll leave that aside. Okay. The solution is to say you are my sister or he is my brother. The solution is to show that Abraham also is related to all those things that they find attractive in Sarah. If you like Sarah, know that I'm her sister, or she's my sister, I'm her brother. Know that everything that you want from her, I also share, and that I should be able to gain from. So if it is, again, you can do this on many levels, cultural, intellectual, even on the beauty standard. And I want to say a kind of blunt sketch character, if you want, of what I think is happening. But it expresses something which I think is a dynamic, which is much more general. Say that Sarah came down and she was really beautiful and everybody wanted to look like Sarah. And it made it difficult for all the other Egyptian women to compete. And so they were struck with a plague that made them white. And they weren't as attractive. And Abraham and Sarah think about this and they say, how can we make use of this? How can we exploit this? How can we use the mistake that the Egyptians think that the attractiveness of someone else can't be found in my own wife, in my own people? How can I make them pay for their mistake of a beauty standard which is false, thinking you can get something better outside of what you can find at home? And they start the Sarah line of cosmetics. They sell Sarah. They make her replicable. They make her copyable. And people can buy a little bit of Sarai makeup. And they can look like Sarah, the model, and they can make themselves lighter or fairer or whatever it is. You should know that ancient Egypt was famous for its cosmetics, and that when the rabbis spoke about coitus, when they wanted to describe what it meant for intercourse to occur, they used a euphemism called kechol b'shfulferet, the placing of the paintbrush into the mascara. The mascara, specifically the mascara that would go around the kohl, the blue, that went around Egyptian eyes. Meaning this makeup obsession of Egypt was known. and a point of cultural pride. And perhaps at one level of analysis, by saying she's my sister, which means I can give you some of this. I can share this with you. I can make it replicable. There is a threat to marriage. And even though they're making use of this, their marriage is threatened because they take Sarah and they abduct her. And so, being in a foreign culture means that my worth as a husband is less, and my wife is being pulled into the orbit of the dominant culture, and that threatens the marriage. There becomes then a confrontation with the foreign culture, where the foreign culture says we've been duped, and they learn something about what really is the value of this person. It's not just saying she's my sister, but it's the relationship that they have. There's an accusation and there's a defense that Avram has to answer. He has to say, I'm sorry. He has to say, I did something which perhaps wasn't so wrong. And it comes around to, but the defense is, there's no fear of God here. That somehow the way you behave and the way we behave is at odds. And it doesn't allow me to be the person or the relationship or the family can't survive the way I need it to survive. We'll talk about that afterwards. There's a punishment, or in the last case, an almost punishment to the foreign culture. There's a healing and a reconciliation. There's a way where these two cultures come back together and they're reconciled. There is extraction, how they pull each other out again. And there's wealth to be gained. From the couples that go down and play this game. So those, I think, are the elements of the story and common to all of them, in different forms. And now I want to look at what's different. Okay? And this I'm going to do quickly because it's not the real point that I want to get to, but we're going to just look at it carefully because there is really a progression through these three stories. First of all, they happen at a further distance. The exile is all the way down to Egypt, and then they come back to the border point of Gerar. The beauty detection happens much more indirectly. Paro's ministers see her and they talk about it to Paro. So her beauty is sort of much more broadcast and goes further. Avimelech just sends and takes himself directly. There's no intermediaries. And finally, Avimelech, in the last case, peers into the window and views her beauty for himself. The fertility of Sarai is very different. In the first story, Sarai is 10 years married with no children at all. In the second story, Sarah goes down with a promise of Yitzchak and has already birthed Yishmael through the surrogacy of Hagar. And in the third story, Yitzchak and Rivka are viewed playing with each other after their parents. Her sexuality, her beauty, is a function of already having birthed Yaakov and Esau. The threat to the marriage also decreases as these cultures come to closer and closer together. A wife is abducted, a wife is taken but left untouched, or the wife isn't taken at all in the last case. The punishment also changes. Plagues, a plague of sexuality, a plague of physicality that affects the body. Wombs shut up, which is a plague of fertility, which might be also in the culture. People who have enough wealth or support to raise healthy children. And then there's almost guilt. Nothing actually happens. Just the threat. What have you done? We're worried that something bad might happen. And finally, the fear of God. It's not mentioned in the first story of Egypt. Abraham defends and accuses or states his defense of what he did was because there was no fear of God. And then the last one, Avimelech educates his people in coming closer to what I want to say is the Torah ethic and puts the fear in his own citizens, saying, you must protect the integrity of this marriage. And so sexuality moves from something being very external and beauty and attraction in bodies to something which is very internal, to about the relationship, about the fear of God, about the integrity of a marriage, about what it does to bring people closer together, and how it builds and strengthens families. And that's really the thrust that I want to get. That attractiveness, when it is used in service of family, is the proper use of sexual attractiveness in all its forms. And when it's used to make America stronger, when the Ford builds a car which is better and wins at Le Mans, well, what does that do? That brings some of the best minds to America. That brings wealth and immigration. That does something similar to, and I just watched Oppenheimer, so it's on my mind, the force of what happens when America becomes a haven for Jewish minds and Jewish intellect. It gives them the atomic bomb. And the rejection of Germany, of all of that intellect, and the throwing out of the Jews means that Germany is directly suffers and becomes less powerful because of that. I know I made a jump there. I'll say it again. America wins at Le Mans. America has more attractiveness. Their cars sell better. People put wealth and investment, minds, intelligent people move to America because of the opportunity, because of the society, because of the wealth. That means that better minds come and more invested, and that produces a self-fulfilling cycle where wealth brings more ingenuity. Ingenuity brings more wealth. Wealth brings a better brand. The better brand is known to give strength. That strength brings better families. Better families brings more opportunity. And culture feeds itself. That can go in a very positive direction that feeds the interest of families and homes. And it can spiral out of control and go wrong as well. And that's what we're going to talk about next. Sex versus fertility. We can separate, and we do, attractiveness, sexiness, from that which results in biological fertility. So here's a story from Genesis where the old tensions between Rachel and Leah, two sisters, result in the following. Leah saw that she had stopped giving birth. And she gives Zilpah to her maidservant and gave her to Yaakov as a wife. Later on, Reuben went out in the time of the wheat harvest and found mandrakes. Mandrakes are an attractive fruit. Some say an aphrodisiac. Some way of, again, externalizing in a medicine, in a potion, in a perfume, something which can externally and culturally enhance your attractiveness and perhaps your fertility. In the field, and he brought them to his mother, Leah. Rachel said to Leah, "Please give me from the mandrakes of your son." She said to her, "Is it not enough that you took my husband, that you would also take my son's mandrakes?" Rachel said, "Therefore, he will sleep with you tonight in return for your son's mandrakes." Look what's happening here. Leah, who's been the less attractive wife all along, actually has more fertility until it stops. But her son is able to bring her a certain amount of attractiveness. She's been successful. And her son is able to enhance her attractiveness by bringing her mandrakes. And Rachel, who has had the first level attractiveness, hasn't been able to translate that into fertility, into success, and into children. And so she wants the thing that Leah has now from having children, from having a son. And they make an exchange and they say, okay, you will now take that attractiveness and sell it to me. And that's what it says. There's an exchange here. In return, you will get to sleep with your husband. Next, Yaakov came from the field and Leah went out to greet him and said, "To me you will come because I have surely hired you with my son's mandrakes." And he slept with her that night. Hashem listened to Leah and she conceived and bore Yaakov a fifth son. This sexual attractiveness, which was exchanged again, and pay attention here. Rachel is the first one to share something with her sister Leah, the bed originally, and now Leah shares something with Rachel. The exchange is complete. We are sharing attractiveness here. And that translation of the original attractiveness gets translated into fertility, which gets translated into something which makes you attractive despite or grows out of that original attractiveness. And then Leah becomes fertile again. And the son is being hired by Yisachar. The word in Hebrew is a play on being hired, Sachar. The other thing to pay attention here is how it is that the women in the family completely control the agency around who, where, when Yaakov sleeps. It's not that Yaakov's in charge. The women are in charge here. And sort of speaking back to gender roles, I want to point out where it's very clear that although there's asymmetries, agency is still very strong, strongly balanced. Okay. This brings us to the next level of Shira. I want to talk about a little bit more attraction and business. Meet Rachav. Rachav is, the Torah says, Yavo Beit Isha Zona, to the house of a woman who is, here translated as the house of a harlot. She lives in Jericho, and before Yehoshua goes into Jericho and conquers Jericho, he sends spies to get some reconnaissance information and sends it to Rahab the harlot. There are various interpretations. Some say a zonah is an innkeeper, a restaurateur, someone who provides the word mazon. Mazon is a play on zonah, bread or food. I want to say it's both. I want to say the attractiveness, the experience that brings you to a fine restaurant, the desire, the cultural of why you want to eat Italian tonight, all of that stuff that makes you pay a lot more money than the pasta you could make for $1.95 back home, you go to an inn, to a restaurant, to have food which has culture, that has desire, that has cuisine. It's not just food, it's cuisine. So there's attractiveness here, which is writ large in the interplay, in a way of making prostitution and innkeeping and desire something of the same thing on the same axis. Okay? I know I'm saying things that are provocative, but that's the point, to be provocative. Rahab reports as follows. The people of Canaan are scared stiff. Their hearts are melted. And you have already won. Remember, this is before Joshua steps in. What does Rahab the prostitute know? She knows the hearts of men. And she knows that everybody has already decided that these Israelite warriors on the frontier are going to beat the smithereens out of us. And so you don't even have to fight, essentially. And that first battle at Jericho was not a fight. All they had to do was march around the city seven times and it crumbles. Why? Because they have a brand. They have a deterrent. They're Israelites and they are known and believed to be stronger. And that belief of their strength is so much more significant than their actual strength. The belief in the brand, in the culture, in what it means to be a Japanese-built car is very significant in making Japanese-built cars more expensive, more successful, which puts more money into their R&D problem in the department, which circles around their culture and continues their success. Success feeds on success here. And so it was with the Jews coming in. They have already won the war. The Megillah tells us that Rahab was the most attractive woman in the world. You mention her name and you immediately lust after her. I didn't want to write it, but the Gemara is even more explicit. You have an immediate seminal emission. That's what it says. Rahab converts and marries Joshua. She becomes the queen of the Jews. If Joshua is king, she's queen. Meaning this harlot is not somebody who is at the low fringe of society. Her attractiveness is leveraged and becomes at the highest level of what makes the strength of the Jewish people. So here becomes the question. Does sex serve family? In the prophet Yechezkel, and I'm going to rush through this here, you should open it up and look at it. In chapter 16, Israel is a foundling, is an abject, rejected baby. God comes and takes care of it and gives it all kinds of gifts and make this foundling beautiful. Israel is a maiden. Then she grows up and she becomes beautiful and attractive. And then God gives this maiden gifts, linen, which are cultural things. They're not innate gifts. They're things that you make, things that you produce, know-how, intelligence, manufacturing prowess. And the problem is that what Israel does with that is she prostitutes them. She trusted in her own beauty and played the prostitute because of her renown. And she sells them to all the cultures around. She uses her gifts not for her husband, not for her own country, but to gain renown and recognition from everybody around. These verses seem to say that there is an intersection between the attention, the attractiveness, the prostitution of this beautiful woman, and business. She's marketing herself. She's putting herself on high grounds. Every rechov, look at that word, every road, every street, every marketplace, that is the same name in Hebrew exactly as rachav. So streets, markets, attractiveness, signs, advertisement, attention seeking, and beauty is part of this nexus. The final point I want to make, and I have to rush through this, is what we said earlier about the sota and the wayward wife, which means that we said there that a woman has to know or can leverage her value, but she can also overcompete. She can, and this is an important correction I want to make from last class. I gave the following scenario, and I want to correct it or refine it. I said the sota could possibly use to get herself out of a bad marriage, and I meant that. Chana uses her sota to gain children out of God, but it's not the way I described it. It's not that a woman plots with her paramour down the block and says, let's be a sota. My husband will accuse me. I'll get a divorce and then I'll marry you. That's wrong. That's licentious. That's terrible. What can be and what I meant to say is a woman only generally can say, I know that I'm worth more. Not that I'm plotting with somebody else, but I know that this man is not treating me with the proper amount of attention and love that I can be. And so I can generate a certain amount of jealousy. And if he doesn't rise to it, I can affect a divorce. And then I will go find somebody better. But she's not inside of the marriage plotting with somebody else. It's much more general. That game of weighing possibilities, of plotting something else, knowing your worth out there, can be a device for raising everybody's worth. But it can also quickly descend into the degrading of sexuality, the degrading of culture, the degrading of everything. And that's where we talked about promiscuity and witchcraft has consumed all desire. When sex becomes like sex, drugs, and rock and roll, a substitute for the joy and the desire and the pleasure that is found in a home, when you are playing it against the family, then it results in a degradation of the whole process. Sex has to be in service of a family. And it's not necessarily directly in service of fertility. It doesn't just mean I need to have more babies. It's much larger than that in terms of what attractiveness does in terms of making people more productive, having better societies, better rules, more integrity. Ultimately, the fear of God, of what makes people have better systems and societies that produce better children. And attractiveness can be used to push that forward. If what the beauty symbol is not just how sexually attractive you are, but what kind of person you are. What, you know, I want to marry that amazing man or woman because of what kind of person they are, what they will bring to my family or my home. Then attractiveness serves the family. So we talked this last time that marriage is a contract. These are my conclusions now. And I know I'm rushing through, but I just want to make this final point here. Let me just take a breath. Here we go. Conclusions. If marriage is like a contract, and think about for a moment, going back to the beginning of the story, Carol Shelby signing on with Ford. He's an individual, and he gains a lot of things and resources by working for the big company of Ford. And if what he's doing is every single day is trying to bid up his contract and going back to Ford and saying, you know, Ferrari can pay me more, or Chrysler can pay me more. And every single day he's negotiating with Ford to pay himself more because he's not loyal to the company. He's not doing his job. He's just trying to get the more contract out of it. So at a certain point, Ford's going to say, you're not worth it. You have to be, if we sign this contract and I hire you, Carol Shelby, then all of your intellectual gifts, all of your innovations are going to be in service of Ford. Everything you gain, everything you're there for, all of your attractiveness, all of your talents are going to be for the family, for the company. And I don't want to hear about the fact that you're going to sell or be disloyal or treat somebody else out. So it's a covenant. It's a contract. It is true, however, that at a certain point, if Ford does not give Shelby what he wants, doesn't make it worth his while, then Shelby will take his talents and go elsewhere. So it requires a covenant. If it's going to be consensual, if people are going to join together to form contracts and businesses and marriages and families, then you have to choose to be in it and choose to stay in it. But there's a dual consciousness, which means in a job, like a marriage, you're supposed to act like it's permanent, like it's all-encompassing, like it's for the entire lifetime. So I'm not trying to extract everything I can right now, and when I'm old and decrepit, I'm no use, you just toss me out because I'm of no utility. This is a covenant which lasts for a lifetime. And even when I'm old and I'm no longer attractive, we owe each other something for the entirety of our gifts. It makes it all encompassing. And one maintains the awareness, however, that termination is still a possibility because it remains consensual. It's not till death do us part. The Jewish marriage includes an awareness at its outset that divorce is an option. Overcompetition and self-interest has the effect of degrading and devaluing those covenants. And so that takes us back to culture and prostitution and what Yechezkel was complaining about and assimilation. Sexual interests can serve marriage when you're taking all of that attractiveness and all of that ability and all of that talent and bringing it home to the family, or they can compete with it. Maybe I can use my attractiveness somewhere else, in a different family, in a different contract, in a different culture, in a different country, and sell it to the highest bidder. Attractiveness includes many things, and they relate all to sex, success, excuse me. They mean to say a person's health, their wealth, the peace, the beauty, their intelligence, all relate to flourishing, and all of those are signaled in attractiveness. Sexual competition is real and effective. And here I'm kind of concluding all of this four-part series for a kind of an overall sense of what I think the Tanakh wants to say about sexuality. Sexual competition is better understood than ignored. We make choices about what it is we choose to put as the most important thing, the most important things that make something attractive. Jealousy can be an important corrective. God is a jealous God. God in that passage in Yechezkel is all upset with Am Yisrael and wants them back. It can be a method by which people come to invest more in the relationship or be aware of how they are abusing the relationship, become aware what's wrong in order to correct. The culture goes to Avram and says, how could you have done this to me? Attractiveness is affected by the cultural field. Being American, being Italian, and being Jewish affects how attractive you are. What you think of about those things, whether you think being a strong and powerful, learned Jew is something which makes you more attractive or not. Being self-aware of what valuations you put on those areas of attractiveness is what the Torah is trying to teach. Being attractive, or what you think is attractive in another person, should be the types of things that serve family. The Torah encourages those qualities, those attractive qualities that make not for the best sex, although it's related. Having good sex is not a bad thing, but in service of being the best mother or the best father you can be. And having good sex is part of being a good mother and a good father, but not all of it. Sex should be in service of family. And that, my dear students, is all I have to say about that. This is just a quick allusion that I get into it. I think all of this can be read into the movie The Fablemans, but that is not for now. Okay, let us take a look at our chat over here, if there are questions that I can look at. I want to again thank you. Maybe I hope if there's opportunity to say or do more, that will be something that we can do. I'm going to come back up on the Zoom for a second here. One second, I have to close the PowerPoint.
You see the few questions in the chat. Do you want me to read them to you?
I'm gonna come to them now. I do see them. Here we go. More attractive, like Israelis just after the Six-Day War. I hope you mean that in a positive way, right? The sense of them having a deterrent. The fact is that deterrent, or that over reliance of the Six-Day War, was part of what made them fall in the Yom Kippur War. That it was a little bit where you can rely on a deterrent, or think you're so attractive that you don't have to continually do something about it, which is part of the story over there. But yes, thank you. That's a good point. Next question. How, or is this different from local pro teams winning the teams composed overwhelmingly by athletes who live elsewhere? Oh, good question. First of all, you know, there's an interesting thing about how teams or professional sports hire mercenaries. Athletes can be mercenaries. You just hire them for the most money. And so really what's being competed here, and it's actually, I think, a very interesting and true thing, is the culture. Does New York City and the New York Yankees have the feedback loop of know-how, of intelligence, of money to create a winning team year after year after year, like Ford? So yes, it's very much like the fact that it doesn't matter if you're a local boy in New York. What matters is that New York City has money and resources to make the Yankees a winning team time and again. And then the Olympics tries to make it more about the national competition, tries to make people, requires, you know, Messi to play for Argentina because he's an Argentinian, right? Not a Brazilian. I hope I'm right about that. Yes, one of the interpretations, most likely, that she's a Cushite means that she's beautiful. But why should Cushite be associated with beautiful? That's exactly the point, that there's an equation that's being done here, that Cushite is associated with being beautiful. And there's an explicit reference in Shir HaShirim where she says, Na'avani v'shchara, I am beautiful and I am black, in Shir HaShirim. So there's definitely inside Tanakh, not a white beauty standard. And it's actually being subverted. But take a look at that other Shir to see that more. In camp can also mean madame. yes, it can, and you're right. I was playing on the point that it's just much more general. I don't think that you have to say that she was selling her body at all. I don't think that was necessarily what Rachav was doing. I think she was making an attractive cultural place to come and enjoy. And whether that was a good Jericho restaurant with a lovely Jericho experience with the taste and sounds of what Jericho has to offer, that speaks to the question in a much more broad way that I think is truer to the dynamic. Yeah, Yankees are in last place. Okay. that addressed the question. That's our questions. Thank you, everybody. It's been really a pleasure. Actually, I'm going to do what I did last time, which is put my email into the chat. And if people had further thoughts or further communications that they want to follow up with, I'd love to hear the sort of things that you'd like to say. I have appreciated your comments and learning with you all along, and I wish everybody well.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much, really, for a very different creative series on a sensitive topic that is not often addressed. So, yashar koach, and you know, I don't know if people know, I think we mentioned the first test. Rabbi DeVoe, of course, grew up in Toronto. And I think he mentioned that he was at his bar mitzvah in my father's, you know, shul. So, even though I didn't know you back then. I'm sorry?
Local boy makes good. That's what
it. Local boy makes good. You know, I'm still in Toronto, but you're in Israel. So, yes, local boy makes good. Lots of local boys making good. So thank you very much, everybody. And thank you.
I just do want to say, I really do want to give thanks and appreciation to Rabbi Kalman and Torah in Motion. It's been really thrilling for me to have this platform to float some ideas with a really intelligent and learned group of people, and having an opportunity to work through a series of ideas has been really a wonderful opportunity. So thank you, Rabbi Kalman and Torah in Motion, for giving that to me.
Okay, thank you. And our next year this week is was a slow week this week. I think only 5 shiurim. Is Parsha Dr. Tammy Jakovitz, who lives in Teaneck, I believe, will be giving the Parsha shiur this week. Next week we'll be having a full slate of shiurim. I put the link there to register for the Elul you know program. So we look forward to learning with you, and everybody have a wonderful day and wonderful rest of the week. And thank you very much. Okay, ciao, ciao. All right, and I was never into car racing. I don't know, Ferrari, the 24 hours, and the Indy 500. I know Al Unser, you know, I remember the Unser brother. That's, I'm aging myself, you know.
Andretti, you must have been
Andretti. Mario Andretti, that's right. Bobby Unser.
I also that's
what I know about car racing.
Jewish boy.
Petty, you know, but, and now I don't know. I don't follow F1. I don't know what's going on there. Okay, very good. Okay, bye-bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.